Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show. Hey there, I'm Dr. Carl Rhodes.
And I'm Natalie Trelaw.
Hey, I'm Christine Leo. And welcome to another awesome episode of Deterrence Down Under. Thank you for joining us. Today we will have the pleasure of discussing an article by Frank Miller and Madeline Creedon entitled Deterring the Nuclear Dictators. What a headline. Which is essentially discussing the three-body problem, the new situation that the United States faces in having to simultaneously deter the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation from acts of aggression against its allies. So Madeline is currently a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution and has a long and illustrious career in the US government, most recently as principal deputy administrator of the NNSA within the Department of Energy. She also served in the Pentagon as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Global Strategic Affairs. She has held many other awesome positions in the U.S. government, and has since retirement, she has also established her own consulting firm, Green Marble Group, and is also a research professor at George Washington University. On a personal note, if you didn't already know it, Madeline is widely regarded as one of the rock star women in the deterrence community. So if you had to ask, then if you need to know, you shouldn't have to ask. Frank Miller, of course, is a principal at the Snowcroft Group. He served for 31 years in the U.S. government, including as special assistant to President George W. Bush, and senior director for defense policy and arms control on the National Security Staff. Fun facts, for his service, Frank received the DoD's Distinguished Civilian Service Medal 5 times. He has been awarded the Norwegian Royal Order of Merit, the French Légion d'honneur, Japan's Order of the Rising Sun, and an honorary knighthood in the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth II for his contribution to US-UK relations. So, Frank is also a rock star and one of my personal heroes, and both, of course, are co-authors. Madeline was chair of the 2022 report, America's Strategic Posture. Why do I say this? Because they're with us here today. We have these two rock stars in the house. I'm delighted to say. So let's get stuck into it. Frank and Madeline, please take us through your superb article, Deterring the Nuclear Dictators.
Well, thanks, Christine. I really appreciate this. And much of this really is drawn from the work of the Strategic Posture Commission. But the bottom line on this is, we know the problem. We know the problem really, really well. The Strategic Posture Commission outlined it. The Biden administration has adopted the characterization of the problem in their June nuclear employment guidance. And so our whole point here is with only 4 years in a Trump administration, they know the problem too, and we just need to get on with it. We need to get on with the modernization. We need to get on with all the very basic things that we have to do and not waste time fundamentally on spending years on a new nuclear posture review. You know, so in this instance, in this time, we all know we need to do. And that's really kind of the guts of the article, right?
I think Madeline has nailed it. I mean, the point is the Strategic Posture Commission used the word urgent over 40 times, and that's exactly right. I mean, we have urgent things to accomplish, and we just simply cannot afford to waste more time on some sort of a policy debate that will break down into endless bickering, but come up with the same basic results as currently our policy, because the policy is sound.
Yeah, thank you. I really like the position that you've taken is that we don't necessarily, that we, like the US and allies, we don't necessarily need to match adversary capabilities on a one-on-one ratio, which is what some are calling for. And it goes to, I think, the eternal and broader question of how much is enough and when is enough enough, about sort of politics and force levels, like what we don't necessarily need, you know, I don't know, 3,500 to overmatch both the US and China. I'm really interested in kind of looking at the history of targeting and doctrine and so forth, like the PSYOP, the NSTLs successively throughout history. What I'm striving to see is, okay, for example, Slicker Men. Yes, we're getting Slicker Men. Awesome. Okay. But the question is not just, okay, Slicker Men is awesome. It's like, okay, well, where's the US language for extended deterrence, for reassuring allies about, you know, what are the operational concepts underpinning, you know, assuming there's a logic in government about these things. Where is the language around when and under what circumstances such a capability might be used? And I saw, Frank, you were at an event at CSIS recently with a Japanese scholar from the Sasakawa Peace Foundation, and he was asking these questions as well. So I'm just curious about, okay, capabilities, but where is the language for extended deterrence? Like, and to what extent might, might we see stronger U.S. language? When might we see stronger U.S. language for reassuring allies in the Asia Pacific?
I can start and then defer to Madeline. I mean, I'd make a couple of points. One, the Strategic Posture Commission was very strong on extended deterrence and allied commitments. Two, I think the U.S. government policy statements have been good, but I think what Madeline and I have been arguing is that our capabilities to back those policy statements up have been lacking, and therefore that's the role of a TLAMN. Now, neither of us can tell you how it would be used or when. I mean, it would be used every day as part of an extended deterrent, but you know, we hope never to get into use. But if use was necessary, that would come under presidential direction. But Madeline, would you want to take this one further?
Yeah, thanks, Frank. You know, I think maybe it makes a little bit of sense to just back up a titch here and think about the fundamental question, because the fundamental question you're asking really is deterrence and how do we maintain deterrence. And when we look at it from that bigger picture, the first part of deterrence is really making sure that the conventional deterrence is sound and strong so that we never get into a military conflict at the outset, so that that military conflict never leads to nuclear use. And it's in that area of strong conventional deterrence that our allies become very, very important. And not only are allies very important in terms of the capabilities that they can bring to the table from a conventional deterrence, but it's also very much incumbent on the U.S. to be able to engage with all our allies so that our allies understand what's expected, and also that we convey how all of these various conventional capabilities would be used in the event of a conflict. So that means planning, and we all need to do, I think, a better job at planning, both on a bilateral and a multilateral basis. So, you know, so I would start there and say, you know, what does it really mean for deterrence? And start with the conventional. And that's where we have lots of weaknesses, and let's work on that. And then, obviously, after that, the nuclear systems of the U.S. are the fundamental guarantee for not only the U.S. but also for our allies. And then we move on to that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, which is, you know, we are working in a budget constrained environment ever more so today, with especially the amount of U.S. debt that exists that's kind of crowding out other capabilities. So How do we really find the right balance between conventional and nuclear? Because more is always better, right? But if you're working in a constrained environment, what is the right amount of nuclear modernization? And I think the current plans, you know, totally make sense. But adding new systems, if they might crowd out important conventional systems, that's a real question. As someone needs to weigh out, what's the deterrent effect of the conventional versus the nuclear in terms of today's environment and how we think about that? And you know, I'll toss that back to you all. There's not really a question there, just a statement as to how we think about this really wicked hard question of balancing nuclear and conventional capabilities and modernization.
Well, first, I'm going to push back a bit. I mean, the we have to modernize the triad because it wasn't done in Bush 43, and the systems are aging, and we're at a point now where if they're not replaced within this 5 to 10 year period, they're going to be retired without replacement, and that's unacceptable. Second, the last time there was a reckoning of the cost was in the first Trump administration. And at that point, the cost of modernization plus continuing to operate the existing force was 7% of the defense budget, with a smaller defense budget. So it's less than that. And the systems that we, in the report that we made under Madeline's leadership, talk about building more, but in the out years, more Columbia submarines, more B-21s. Those are out year costs. They're not the next 5 years. And the next, the final question is what are the conventional capabilities we're talking about? I mean, you can spend a lot and waste money. I mean, the poor old Army hasn't developed a successful modernization program in 30 odd years. But we know we can build tanker airplanes or buy tanker airplanes, which we desperately need, and we haven't. We need prompt conventional strike systems that have medium to long range, and the Navy is going to put those out in penny packets as opposed to the forces necessary to deter in 28 and 29. So, I mean, I think there's a good balance. It's going to take some hard looking, and the services, I think, need to be brought to heel by the Secretary of Defense. It's a personal opinion. I don't associate anybody with it. But I think the services have for too long been in charge, and that leaves the combatant commanders in the field without the things that they say they need. But I turn over to Madeline.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, one of the real issues for this administration that I think they need to focus on is not only getting this balance right about really implementing the Goldwater-Nickel approach. In other words, the combatant commanders are the ones who are supposed to identify needs, and then there's a process to take those needs and turn them into requirements, and then the services are supposed to build and develop those things that meet those requirements so that the combatant commanders have something to use in the event of a conflict. But that absolutely has to be addressed. But in many respects, because we are in a situation where I don't have a lot of confidence that we're going to have increases in the defense budget, although there will be a raging debate on Congress about that, I think we also had to get a lot smarter how DoD buys stuff. There's some good work going on. I mean, DIUX, that Defense Innovation Unit, they're trying some things, but the services have to get a little more creative. And frankly, there's a huge role for Congress here too, because every time Congress program that has a failed test, well, you know, the sky is falling and they cancel the program. And in reality, a failed test is actually something that you learn from. And so I think Congress has to calm down a little bit in many respects and also maybe remove a lot of the restrictions that drive some of the really extended procurement requirements. You know, it's why DoD takes 10 years to buy something that in the private sector should take a year.
I want to double down on Madeline's point. The Strategic Modernization Program was kicked off in the Obama administration about 2011 or so. You know, the first Columbia-class boat's going to enter the water about 2028. That's a long time. It's 18 years. We went from concept of Polaris as submarine, missile, and warhead to first deployment in 5 years. 5 years. Same thing with Minuteman. There's no reason for us to go through this extended period of navel gazing when we need to get on with the program. And I think part of that is, and that wastes money. I mean, the longer you take, the more money you waste in costs that don't get you anything. So again, I think it requires someone at the very top of the system saying, do this and do it now, and here's your deadline, and get on with it.
And that's really all part of these fundamentals that we're arguing in the article for the Trump administration to focus on. I mean, we need these basics. We need an industrial base to be able to produce the things that are going to be needed in the future. I mean, I'll give a very oversimplified analogy. So, you know, I can fantasize all I want about an 8-tier cake, right? But if I don't have the flour and the sugar and the butter, that cake's never going to happen. So that's where kind of we are. You know, right now we're trying to gather the flour, the sugar, and the butter. We're trying to reconstitute the industrial base. We're trying to rebuild facilities at NNSA that, I mean, literally some of them date back to the Manhattan Project. And a new facility at NNSA is probably something that was built in the 70s. We're trying to regain the people. You know, we just lost the people who have the capabilities to make all of these systems that we need, and we need to regain all of that. So there's so much that needs to be done from a very basic aspect before we can really move on to you know, thinking a lot more about what we might need. And that's really the job, I think, of this administration. They have to stick to the basics and lay the foundation for the things that we need. Now, that said, you know, there are some things that we may be able to do. We talked about, and I'll go to the nuclear side here for a minute. We talked about, both in the article and also in the Strategic Posture Commission, if we need to deploy more nuclear warheads, depending on where China and Russia go, we have the ability to do that now. But that's also something I think this administration is going to have to wrestle with. When New START expires, do we need more? And if we need more, what do we need them for? And how do these capabilities that we can deploy, how do they actually get deployed? In other words, what has to be done to keep them updated? You know, do we have the money? All of those sorts of things, if we really need them. But we got to stick with the basics here for a while.
Yeah, I mean, that's in terms of delays, you know, I'm less worried about a delay on people making a decision about Slicaman or not, or, you know, maybe tinkering at the edges of ICBM. It's really the industrial system where there's a lot of delays, you know, weapon systems delays, NNSA, you know, creating some delays here and there. We need to move fast like we used to be able to do in the Cold War. And how do we rebuild that capability to move quickly, just like Frank was talking about with Minuteman? You know, that was a system that was deployed very quickly, and the Sentinels taking decades to deploy. So how do we move quicker and get more responsive in the way that our adversaries are moving very quickly right now?
You know, it's hard, right? I mean, we haven't done this in 20 some years, and we're now trying to modernize everything all at once and rebuild the industrial infrastructure. So it's hard. And I get that. And we're going to be slower and we're going to be over budget for a while. But the key is to figure out and to get the right people so that we, and the right policies on procurement, so that we can actually do this, so that we never find ourselves in this pickle again. You know, we're in this because we stopped doing things. And I think we've learned a huge lesson. You know, the lesson is don't stop doing things. Because you pay
and that ability
price.
To bump up to roughly, I think it's 2,500 warheads, you know, deployed at a relatively low cost just by uploading, you know, Minuteman and some of the subs again, gives us a bit of breathing room. But, you know, we really need to move quickly. So I'll pass it back to Christine there.
Yeah, no, great points. And it goes to a topic that both Carl and I are passionate about, which is readiness, as you call it in the United States. I think it'll be interesting to see how the U.S., broadly speaking, thinks about and manages readiness for both a European and an Asia-Pacific context, which... you know, you just look at the logistics of power projection, the nature of logistics of power projection in both regions, which are vastly different. It'll be interesting to see how trade-offs are made given that the U.S. has to manage now these two regions simultaneously. Natalie, I think you have a question on the role of allies in the Asia Pacific. And again, I've forgotten his name, but Frank, the Japanese scholar you talked with at the CSIS event in October, he was raising the questions about, for example, you know, like Japan is having to think for the first time in a very long time about questions of nuclear strategy and so forth. And that is the case for other allies such as, you know, Australia and even to a much lesser extent, but, you know, they'd like to ignore the problem, but the problem's there, New Zealand. Natalie, the role of allies, please go.
So I really appreciate the way that the article, you know, discusses the problems in the US industrial base and comes out with a shopping list of items to prioritize within that. How important do you think it is that in the nearer term that the president will need to prioritize the other revised guidance from the report on nuclear employment strategy of the United States? So, for example, requiring the integration of non-nuclear capabilities into the US nuclear planning where non-nuclear capabilities can support the nuclear deterrence mission, stressing the importance of managing escalation in US planning for responding to limited strategic attack, enabling deeper consultation, coordination, combined planning with NATO and Indo-Pacific allies and partners in order to strengthen US extended deterrence commitments. And then how important is it for those points to be linked to the point for allies and partners in that, where allies can contribute to nuclear deterrence by alleviating burdens on US conventional dual capable forces or by augmenting their conventional support to enable US nuclear operations in a contingency?
Well, I think they're all very important, but neither is it very new. I mean, the things that you mentioned have all been tenets of U.S. policy. The trouble is we stopped doing it, and we forgot how to do it. And I think that's part of the problem. Integrating. I mean, the wars. If a war starts, it's going to begin, and if a nuclear weapon is used, the war is not going to simply stop. So we have to integrate our capabilities. But the other thing is, I'm going to push back somewhat on what you, Christine, said. These are two different wars. I mean, a war in Europe is mostly ground war with air support. The NATO allies have lots of ground forces, and the Russian military ground forces have shown themselves to be pretty poor. The war in the Pacific is an air and naval war. We will have to shift naval and air assets to the Pacific. NATO allies are going to have to pick that up in the Atlantic and the Baltic. But, I mean, I think that we're capable of doing that. I mean, I'd like to have more. Yeah, would I like to have more? I'd like to have a lot more attack submarines. But we're not going to get those in the near term. But I wouldn't overstress the resource competition, except for tankers. Tankers bothers me a lot. That keeps me up at night.
No, I think it's, I think it's true. I just want to add on a little bit here with Frank. I mean, most conversations come back to tankers. And this is something that not only is the U.S. Really, really, really late to the table on, but this is also something where, allies can also be able to fill that niche in a big way. This is just something that is absolutely essential. It's essential to the conventional fight, and it's essential to the nuclear fight. And it's a really good way for allies to participate as well, assuming we can all figure out how to do this together, which is a huge challenge.
I mean, one of the other things that I've often seen in my past work at the RAND Corporation was a lack of conventional weapons, precision-guided munitions. And that's another shortfall that has always been the case and is one where allies could contribute through industrial base. And Australia is trying to work on this in terms of building a guided weapons explosive ordnance capability here locally. But I think this is a global industrial base problem for the West. How do we build enough of these weapons should the flag go up? And you can't build them during the conflict. You need to have them in the storehouses already as well. A concern and a potential way for allies to contribute.
Absolutely.
Yeah, those are great points. I think it's really interesting, and I'd be curious to know, Frank and Madeline, your thoughts on what U.S. allies in the Asia-Pacific region, like what do you think they could be doing more of if you had a wish list, if you had a shopping list?
Well, you know, some of it depends on, are we talking conventional or nuclear? And I know the nuclear question is just a hard question. So it's one of the reasons why in the Strategic Posture Commission report, we talked about nuclear systems that are flexible, that are deployed or deployable. And what we meant by that was deployed or deployable in a way where they don't have to be on other countries' land. You know, that's where all of this starts to get really difficult in terms of the conversations, in terms of obligations, just, you know, larger obligations under the NPT, and, you know, just, I mean, that just gets really complicated. So that's why we're, you know, we were focused in the commission on finding these things that are deployed or deployable. And even a TLAM-N would be deployed in the region on a ship, right, or a submarine or whatever the Navy decides to put them on. So, you know, these are the things that we're looking at. One of the things that you might in the Asia Pacific look at as far as a lesson from NATO is in NATO, you know, obviously, you know, there's dual capable aircraft, but in the states that are not basing nations, they also have a responsibility or an obligation to sort of help support the nuclear capability in NATO. And so one of the things that they might do is they might provide, you know, dispersal bases for a DCA if the DCA have to disperse. So, you know, these might be some things that we begin to take a look at and talk to some of our Asian allies just about, you know, sort of like hosting bombers, this sort of thing.
I agree completely. You know, and the other thing is going back to the point Madeline and I both have made is, I mean, the RAAF has tankers. The Japanese Air Force has tankers. You know, we need to buy more tankers. I mean, these are important. Electronic warfare capabilities, the wedge tails, you know, buy more of those. And, of course, the Japanese Navy is, people don't look at it, but it's pretty capable. And they've just gone with the... unveiled their first aircraft carrier with F-35Bs, which they've been sort of hiding for a decade. You know, move ahead with the AUKUS program and enhance U.S. Enhance U.S. And allied SSN capabilities in the Asia Pacific area, which are Tomahawk shooters. So, I mean, all of that is a major allied contribution in the Pacific.
No, absolutely. You know, absolutely. I mean, the work that Australia is doing to build out some of the submarine bases in Western Australia, you know, outside of Perth, to be able to host the U.S. fast attack submarines. You know, all of that are exactly the sorts of things that allies can do. The other thing, which you haven't mentioned yet, too, is in an Asia-Pacific war. ISR, right? Intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance is going to be hugely important just because of the size of that particular theater. And China clearly has been very active in terms of their anti-satellite capabilities. And so when we look at the space capabilities that Australia is building up, that Japan has, that South Korea has, you know, looking at all of these additional assets that could be developed and launched, to provide additional ISR capabilities from space or even in near space, or looking at how you provide some of these capabilities from, you know, even high altitude UAVs. You know, these are all the sorts of things that we as allies need to talk about, because these are all going to be very essential things if there's any sort of a war or even in the run up to a war, so that we understand what others are doing. Over.
No, thank you. Great, great, great points. I have a sort of a theoretical question, as in international relations theory question, but one that has practical Well, that has practical implications, absolutely. And it's one that Natalie and I have discussed a little bit, is that some Japanese officials recently have brought up the fact that there is no sort of Asian NATO. And there's a bit of history to that, which Elaine Bunn discussed recently, like CETO and CENTO. Yes, those were alliances, but they didn't work because they weren't fit for purpose. The countries didn't have the same threat perceptions and sense of obligation to each other. I'm just curious, to what extent do you think we quote-unquote may need an Asian NATO? Like, to what extent is a formal alliance really that important to demonstrating, I guess, multilateral resolve in deterring China?
You know, first of all, we don't have an Asian NATO, but we have ties to, I mean, formal ties with Australia, Japan, and ROK. And now we're beginning to work the three together. I mean, so I'm not sure that you need a formal NATO in Asia. I think the biggest thing about NATO is that you have a Supreme Allied Commander Europe, and you have forces that operate and train together and that can be ordered into battle together, who operate together, and you have NATO defense plans, war plans, if you will. And I think that's an integrated deterrent, or at least it's the foundation of an integrated deterrent. I think we need to do that in the Pacific, certainly with the Japanese and Australian forces, and if you have integrated U.S., Japanese, Australian naval and air capabilities, and as Madeline was saying, ISR capabilities, space capabilities, which both nations are spacefaring nations as well. I mean, these things need to be integrated, and then you're going to get something where the sum is stronger than the just basic addition of the parts one to another.
You know, I'm keeping with the philosophical aspect of that question. You know, there are probably two things I think that you'd have to think about. One is, you know, obviously in NATO, they're all contiguous countries in a large landmass that's threatened in a very near-term way by Russia from a geographical distance. And you don't have that, right? So that's thing one that makes them obviously quite different. The other thing that I wrestle with, and I don't know how to answer it, is within NATO, there's very much an understanding, because of this very close geographical relationship with Russia and NATO, that if one NATO country is attacked, the other NATO countries are going to come to its defense. So it isn't just about the U.S. coming to the aid of an ally. It's all of those allies coming to the aid of each other. Okay, and that is something, that's a philosophy that hasn't yet been achieved in the Asia Pacific. So I think before you got to a situation where you had some sort of a Asian NATO, you would have to get over that philosophical issue, because right now it's the U.S. coming to the aid of each country separately, pursuant to the bilateral agreements. You know, and I have trouble thinking, okay, so if Australia is attacked, would you expect Korea to come to your aid? You know, these are to me the philosophical questions that at some point would have to be unpacked. You know, notwithstanding that everybody, I think, in the region has the potential, either militarily or economically, to be threatened by China. So that may be the unifying factor, but I just don't think we're there yet. And there's just a lot of reasons that we may never get there. Over.
Madeline, Frank, what do you have any sort of, can you provide us some insights as to what you think's impeding that sort of mentality between the Asia Pacific?
I think largely because you don't have the same history that, you know, you have in Europe. I mean, you look at the European countries having lived under the Soviet Union, and then with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, you know, there's still this long history there, this long memory, and that just doesn't exist in the Asia Pacific.
Yeah. And what sorts of things do you think could improve that? Like, is, does that come down to this planning and understanding the threat from a sort of combined sort of perspective as well?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that you ever will, and I'm actually not sure you ever need to, really, because it's just different. So really, as Frank said, focusing on not only the bilateral, but also the multilateral relationships, like the quad, like the, with the trilats, you know, doing the exercises, understanding, because, it, you know, at the end of the day, if there is an event, all of those countries are going to have to cooperate and work together and be coordinated. And that, I think, is really more important for the Asia Pacific. Instead of, you know, trying to recreate some sort of an Asian NATO, it's really just more important to make sure that from a real practical perspective that they can operate together.
And that's there, I think, where there's a lot of money to be made, because you can get military chiefs and theater commanders to begin to work out integrated war plans without getting to political leaders creating, you know, an Article 5 for the region, which will inevitably create political issues, domestic political issues. You don't have to do that. I mean, if there's an understanding, and there is, that the, you know, that the government of Japan has indicated that that attacks on the Philippines, the attacks on the ROK, will draw it into the fray, then they need to be able to do that without raising it to a meta political issue that has to go to parliaments and, you know, be voted on as a treaty.
Well, the other piece is intelligence, you know, and I think because all the, you know, allies obviously live in the Asia Pacific, allies live in the Asia Pacific, duh. There's a lot of intelligence sharing that can come from all of this, because each one of those allies has a very different perspective of what China is doing and why. And I think that's also hugely important in terms of the relationship amongst and between all of the allies in the Asia Pacific region, as well as understanding the economic implications, which also makes that region very, very different from NATO.
Now, really, really important points, really good insights there for sure. And I was going to ask about, Frank and Madeline, your thoughts on proliferation potentially in the region among friendly nations. Some in Japan, some in Korea have talked about potentially deploying nuclear weapons to deal with the threats. It's been less of a discussion here in Australia, but I feel like we're getting closer to that discussion given the Chinese, you know, extended deployment of many more nuclear weapons to potentially get ready for conflict here in the Asia Pacific. So what are the trade-offs, and what are your thoughts on other nations, friendly nations, developing their own nuclear weapons? Would that help or hurt deterrence? And what are some of the complications? It's a really complicated question. I get it. We could probably spend 2 hours, but would appreciate your thoughts.
Well, I want to spend 2 hours. I mean, I think the first answer is that the U.S. extended deterrent is one of the best, is the best anti-proliferant that's ever existed. The second thing is, you know, all of this loose talk about, well, we should get our own deterrent, ignores the fact that it's going to take 15 to 20 years to get a deterrent. And I do remember in 2006 when I was visiting Japan, and I was clearly being steered, and people would say to me, you know, we could have a bomb in 6 months. And I'd say, yeah, and in 20 years and $60 to $100 billion, you could have a deterrent, which means a nuclear force which is survivable under secure command and control, which can't be preempted and all the rest. And oh, by the way, you know, if you say you're going to build a nuclear deterrent, you're going to opt out of the NPT and you're going to be uncovered for about, you know, 15 to 20 years. So it's not all as easy as it turns out that the scholarly articles would suggest.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, this is absolutely one of those things where it's just, you know, it's quite easy to throw it out and it's really, really hard to implement. And why would you want to anyway? You know, why would you want to take on all of the issues that the U.S. has maintaining a deterrent? You know, what country in its right mind would want to do that?
Yeah, very, very good points. Very good points. And a reminder as to the complication of maintaining a nuclear deterrent and maintaining a safe and survivable nuclear deterrent at that. It's not just building the weapon. There's a whole enterprise that goes with it. Very good points.
Yeah, they are excellent points. one of the professors that I really like, Frank Gavin, he's moved around a bit, but he's a nuclear historian. He has raised some interesting points about the history of U.S. policies, official and unofficial, towards different countries acquiring nuclear weapons. And it's not been all that consistent over time, but it'll be interesting to see the future of the nuclear age, because it is still a very young age in the grand scheme of history. So, as Frank said, you know, put your seatbelts on. We're in for a rocky ride. But thank goodness we have such wonderful experts that are willing to discuss these issues with us, such as Frank and Madeline. We've been absolutely delighted to have you with us today. Thank you so much for your time and your consideration. Carl, Natalie, any final thoughts?
No, I just wanted to thank our guests and just remind us that to always think deterrence, like we close every episode. Natalie, over to you.
I just think from an Australian perspective, we sort of face that, you know, will the US be prepared to trade off, I don't know, LA for Sydney or whatever?
Because Canberra isn't that important? Just kidding.
Hey, we have the beaches here in Sydney.
Yeah, that's true. We need the beaches. Yep. So thank you so much, Frank and Madeline, and thank you so much to our listeners for joining us. And remember to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.